future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Welcome, welcome, Raging Chickens, out to coop live. Well, it's kind of not quite true this week, just like it wasn't quite true last week. This is our normal time for out to coop live. However, I am on vacation. So this is another special out to coop live, and this is for Monday, July 5th, 2021. On out to coop live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and from across the country. And on Friday, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And don't forget to check out the Wednesday show with Cyril Michaleko. Cyril's a progressive columnist for the Bucks County Courier-Times and Intelligencer, and he normally joins me to drill down into Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and international politics. But this week, actually, I handed over the steering wheel to Cyril. So he's got some interviews that are coming up. And I should say last week, I think you probably have already heard one of Cyril's shows by now, which is pretty cool. But you can subscribe to all of our podcasts on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. And you can help support this show becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you were watching this on YouTube, make sure you hit that subscribe button. And if you're not watching it on YouTube, head on over to our YouTube page, our YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe, make sure you like the stream, and make sure you hit that notification bell so that you know every time that we go live. So the special show I've got for you, I'm going to have a limited introduction today, is going to be the first interview that we ever conducted in Raging Chicken. It was back on November 22nd, 2011. And we first published the full video interview on December 14th of 2011. And it was with the one, the only Noam Chomsky. So it was pretty remarkable to land Noam Chomsky as a first interview. Even this was right after Raging Chicken just got started. He was, so incredibly influential in my own political development, and that could be said for, you know, millions of other people too as well. I remember reading his stuff in college and having my mind opened. So he was speaking at Kutztown University as part of World Philosophy Day, and we had just gotten Raging Chicken started, and I'm like, God, wouldn't that be great to get an interview with Noam Chomsky? And I was talking to some people about it. And I think even said this to Sean. And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, look, what could it hurt to ask? Right. My initial thoughts were like, yeah, well, you know, who the heck am I? Just a brand new little tiny publication just got started. Why the heck would he give me the time of day? But like so many other folks will tell you, you know, we told him a little about our politics, told him a little about what we were doing, talked to his scheduler, and he was happy to give us the time. So he gave us about, 45 minutes before he had to leave the next day. And it was really remarkable. It was a phenomenal conversation. Now, I need to give you some heads up about this recording. And this has always been one of my greatest regrets about this opportunity is that because we were so new, we had no idea what the heck we were doing. The setup that we had for the interview was not the best. It was in the side room in the kind of hotel he was staying in, or this, this hotel, this inn he was staying in, which had high ceilings. It was very echoey. We only had one video camera, and now I would have totally have done it. We would have external mics. We would have done it with a digital recorder, all this. We didn't have any of that equipment. We literally had one video recorder, and that was it. I think we had somebody might have been recording it on their phone or a digital recorder separately, something like this. So I'll tell you off the bat, the quality of the audio is not great. And I can tell you there was a comment. Let me see if I can pull it up. This is from when it was originally released. There was this great comment by this guy, Randy, and he said, "Thanks so much for doing this, but the background noise is ridiculous." You know, and I had to agree with him at the time. Now, since I've learned more about audio and stuff over the years, and especially since we started doing our podcast, I was able to pull out a lot of some of the background noise, the most distracting background noise that was just like humming over our discussion. So that was good. However, it's still very echoey. There's times where the mic doesn't pick up everything that he says. But I thought it was worthwhile bringing back as a special rebroadcast, in part because he was talking so much about social movements and what social movements can achieve. Now, this was November in 2011. This is about a couple months after Occupy movement had gotten going. And much of our discussion revolves around the Occupy movement, about the role of, say, universities in education or in social movements. And we talk a little bit about Chris Hedges' book that came out at the time. But it's in three segments. So the way this will roll out today, obviously you can't see this, this isn't a podcast. So when we first put this out, we had kind of intro titles, which gave you some of the questions that we're going to talk about in the segment, and then it moved right into the segment where you hear Noam Chomsky speaking. Most of what you're going to hear is Noam Chomsky. In the second and third segment, you'll hear a little bit of me asking some additional follow-up questions and that kind of stuff, but most of it will be just Noam Chomsky. So the first segment of the interview was on the Occupy movement, and we had the subtitle of it, An Unprecedented Movement for Unprecedented Times. And that is kind of how Chomsky himself framed it. So without further ado, I want to turn it over to the one, the only Noam Chomsky for part one of our interview on the Occupy movement, An Unprecedented Movement for Unprecedented Times.
Well, the Occupy movement, as I said in that talk, in fact, is quite unprecedented. I can't think of anything analogous to it. But these are quite unprecedented times. We are now in beyond the 30th year of a very sharp change in American history. If you take a look at American history since the beginning, I mean, there were various ups and downs, and it wasn't very pretty in a lot of ways, but there was a rather steady tendency towards growth, development, industrialization, a sense of hope for the future. And that was true even in really dark times. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Depression, and my family were mostly working class, mostly unemployed. And objectively, it was a lot worse than it is now, but subjectively, it was different. There was a sense of hope. CIO was organizing. There were sit-down strikes. WPA was doing occupations. There was worker education. My unemployed relatives, some of them never got past fourth grade, were going to Shakespeare plays. They had a high culture. The union, my aunt, seamstresses, unemployed seamstresses, were in Hillwood, you know that. Mm-hmm. And so it was a world, it was a life.
Yeah.
And a community, a week in the country, something to do. There was a sense that we're in it together, we're going to get out of it. That's just not true now. For the last 30 years, it started in the 70s, there was a sharp change in the economy, conscious change, towards deindustrialization of the country. Industrial production continues. So Apple computer still continues, but at Foxconn.
Right.
So when you buy an Apple computer, you're buying something where the parts, the components, a lot of development comes from Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and it's assembled in China with very little value added, incidentally, under horrendous working conditions. And then you buy it here, and the profits go back to Apple. It's the same across the industrial system. So by now, you know, in manufacturing, real unemployment is about the level of depression, but with a big difference. In the late 30s, you had a sense that it's going to come back, that we're going to get it back, you know, we can do it. And now the sense among working people with some justification is that unless policy changes sharply, we're not going to get it yet. It's over. And there's a general sense of malaise in the country. Sort of, we see it the same is true in attitude towards institutions like Congress, you know, might as well disappear, everybody hates them. And the same is true of just about every other institution. Others, and it's objective. I mean, for the roughly 30 years, real incomes have barely grown for most of pretty much stagnated for most of the population. For a tiny sector, I mean, it's so small it's not even picked up in the census. But there has just been spectacular wealth. It's actually about a tenth of 1%. And that reflects the other major change in the economy, along with the deindustrialization, conscious deindustrialization of the country, came financialization. So investors could make more money playing ridiculous games with speculation and so on. Can you move this other guy out by a second? And the financial sector grew enormously. By 2007, before the latest crash, it was about 40% of corporate profits, and it doesn't do anything for the economy. In fact, probably harms it. But it does create enormous, highly concentrated wealth. Also, draws plenty of talent away from other things. So, take say my own university, MIT Science University, has a great math department. But a large part of the math department is now devoted to financial mathematics, which is just a waste to undermine the economy with various kinds of trickery. And that's not only harming society, but it's also drawing away talent that could be used for, you know, developing advanced engineering and production for the things that people need. And the society's not going to survive if it doesn't produce things people need. It can go on the basis of inertia for a long time, but it's a self-inflicted decline. And for the population, you've got this tremendous gap between stagnation, malaise, lack of hope for the future, and fantastic wealth. I mean, I remember a couple of weeks ago, there was front page of the New York Times had two stories. One of them was about the growth in the poverty rate, you know, the disillusionment, the lack of hope, that people can't buy what they need, they're not good food man. Mm-hmm. Right next to it was a story about how in luxury stores they're raising prices, because it doesn't matter how much you raise the prices, people are going to buy it anyway. So, and that's the country. Well, out of this, the Occupy movement is actually the first organized large-scale protest directed to the whole set of problems. The Wisconsin was very important, but that was specific. It was due to the efforts of the governor to try to destroy the last remnants of working-class organization. And that was very impressive mobilization against that. But the Occupy movement is it's kind of across the board. It's going after the whole range of issues that is destroying the society. And in that respect, it's very hopeful and kind of inspiring that people who are involved are putting themselves in the line. And a lot of fun to sleep in the park day after day. They've also developed communities. There's a sense of solidarity that's been reemerged. And that was always the core of the labor movement. Solidarity wasn't just a slogan. It meant you're working together. You know, we're part of broader society. And that's being rebuilt within these movements, and it's quite significant, I think. They're setting up kind of bonds, associations, learning how to do things together, community kitchens, health centers, libraries, and, well, that's the positive side. The power never says, come on, yeah, thanks, take it away from you. It's going to fight back. And we happen to have, if you look at U.S. history, it's a It's different than European countries for a lot of reasons, but it has a highly class-conscious business community, always fighting a bitter class war, very conscious about it. You read the business literature, it reads like the red mouse red book with the values of the, you've got to fight the everlasting battle to win the minds of the men and overcome the organization of the masses, which is a threat to power. I mean, it's in fact, the shift in the '70s came from organized efforts to respond to the dangerous democratizing tendencies of the 1960s. That was pretty explicit. I could talk about it, but anyway, it's explicit plan. And now that this movement is developing, the backlash is, of course, developing along with it. And there's going to be barriers. You don't win things quickly. It takes a long time. I mean, say, civil rights movement. It didn't begin when Martin Luther King made a speech. It started in the 30s. And a lot of long struggle. Early, 1960, you get kids sitting in a lunch counter, freedom riders. Finally, a big movement developed. But it's interesting to learn a lot about the United States by seeing what happened to it. As long as Martin Luther King was talking about racist Alabama sheriffs, he was popular among, relatively popular among elites. As soon as he began shifting to class issues, he was killed off. When you listen to the speeches on Martin Luther King Day about how great he was, it typically ends with, "I had a dream," not with, "I'm organizing a queer people's movement," or "I'm going to Memphis for a sanitation strike," where he's assassinated. And that reflects the deep-seated elite ideology that the only thing that matters is the rich and the powerful, and the rest are sort of in the way. Of course, not the way the population thinks about it, but it's the way power sees itself. It's the media, and so on and so forth. So it's going to be a long, hard struggle. You can't just sit in a park forever. You have to reach out to the community. You have to organize other groups. There was a poll that was just reported today saying that about half the population doesn't understand what the Occupy movement's about.
In part two of the interview, we kind of pick up from where segment one left off. And the segment two, we titled "The On the Occupy Movement, Bonds of Association and Solidarity." These terms were his terms that he used, which seemed to me to be so important at the time and have remained such, have remained these kind of important terms that I've continue to go back to, right? He talks about bonds of association and solidarity as being essential to social movements. So without further ado, once again, here is part two of my interview with Noam Chomsky back on November 22nd, 2011. 2011. Noam Chomsky.
Well, I'm glad to hear what you were saying too about the bonds of association and solidarity. That this is one of the things that I think it's also most difficult to communicate to people about how this is absolutely critical for any kind of long-term sustainability. And, I look at the labor movement, which I've been active with. My family's been labor folks from the beginning. But one of the things that seems to me is that's one of the few places where you have a historical memory of what those bonds of association mean in very practical material terms.
That's one of the reasons why there's such an effort to destroy the labor movement. I mean, the U.S. has a very violent labor history as compared with comparable countries. And the labor movement several times has been smashed. Like one of the great books, I'm sure you know, of American labor history, David Montgomery's Rise and Fall of the Labor Movement. The fall that he's talking about is the 1920s. Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare practically wiped out the labor movement. In the 1920s, right-wing columnists, journalists from England, Australia, were coming here. They couldn't believe how working people were treated. You could get away with that in the conservative circles in other countries. Well, it constituted in the 30s and in the 40s even more so. And it, but the backlash started right away. I mean, as soon as the war was over, in 1947, Taft-Hartley, he started with huge campaigns to try to undermine support for labor and undermine this notion of solidarity. I mean, it's not just labor. You take a look at the what's called the Republican Party. It's not a political party in the traditional sense anymore. For the last 20 years, it's been so deep in corporate pockets, you need a telescope to find it. Now, they try to cover it up, you know, so we've got to have no taxes on the rich because they're job creators. They've got so much money coming out of their pockets, so they don't know what to do with it. But you keep saying job creators, job killing, and the media just repeat it. It's kind of like North Korea.
Yeah.
But if you look at what they're opposed to, it's very striking. It's not just labor. Of course, they're opposed to labor. They're opposed to Social Security. Why are they opposed to Social Security? Why do they pretend that Social Security is a deficit problem when they know it isn't? Front page story at USA Today. They know it isn't. Why are they trying to destroy public schools? You take a look at the things they're trying to destroy, and it's the ones that are based on solidarity. Social Security, the fundamental idea is I'm supposed to care if the disabled widow across town doesn't have food in it. And that's what they try. And same with public schools. Like, I don't have kids in school, but the public school system means that I'm happy to pay my taxes so the kid across the street can go to school. And all of these things that are the targets of what's called conservative, meaning ultra-reactionary propaganda, and across the board in the media and everywhere else, is really aimed at the conception that you ought to care about other people. I mean, that's kind of the opposite of the, you know, kind of Randian notion, we just are out for ourselves and hope everyone knows. That battle goes way back. In fact, back to the early days of, it's very interesting to read the, it was very lively labor press in the mid-19th century, the early days of industrialization. And one of the themes that comes through, it really resonates today, is a denunciation of what they call the new spirit of the age. This is 1850, the new spirit of the age. Gain wealth, forgetting all but self. That's what they regard as just undermining their basic humanity. Working people, you know, factory girls from the farms, artisans from the boss. And that battle's still going on. Gain wealth, forgetting all but self. So the hell with Social Security, get rid of public schools, destroy unions, everybody in it for yourself and themselves. But I'm going to win because I have all the power. So you guys are just going to suffer. Be the slave labor force, or not the labor force.
Yeah, and I said, you know, one of the things that you said, like this question that was asked you last night, is a question that you hear over and over and over again about, well, what can we do? That question. And it always astounds me, right? The story I always tell, like, you know, I grew up with punk rock, right? Punk rock is a DIY culture, right? You saw a problem, right? You whined about it for a while, and then you did something about it. And it's been remarkable to me that question is out there, and the agency that's just given over in the question itself, right? By saying, well, what can I do? And one of the things that you said in response to that was, look, there's no shortage of opportunities, right? And I think you said there's a shortage of dedication. Right,
there's a sense it should work tomorrow, and this is part of the. I mean, it's understandable when young people, you know, I don't have time.
Sure.
I want to do something else. But whatever you think about the old Communist Party, you know, the people. There was one really good thing about it. They knew that they were in it for the long term. That you're not going to win tomorrow. You're going to have a defeat, but we got to be around for the next time. And you get a kind of continuity of, you know, there were learning experiences. You learned how to have a demonstration, how to organize a strike. You didn't have to learn it new every time. There's always somebody around to turn the mimeograph machine in those days. You know, that kind of dedication and willingness to be in it for a long-term struggle, it's been a little bit swept away by the more or less instant gratification culture. You can see it in the, it was true in the 60s too. So for example, in the 1968, when students had a strike at Columbia, there was a big strike, and sat in the president's office. I remember the kids I knew I was talking to. And they really thought that if they sat in the president's office for a couple of weeks, that there would be a world of peace and love and pot and friendship and so on. And it doesn't happen that way. You're going to get rousted out by the cops. It would be pretty brutal. And you got to be ready for the next step. And that didn't happen. So then they were kicked out, sort of disappeared. And that kind of thing is what you have to get over. It was the same with, say, the Iraq War. It was first time in the history of imperialism, first time, that there was a massive protest before the war was officially launched. But then the war came, of course, and the protest declined just when it should have been picking up. But that's the kind of thing that has to be overcome. It's not going to be an easy struggle. Nothing ever is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that I find remarkable, I always go back to like Miles Horton when he talks about the long haul. And I thought that tradition, what I remember, I didn't even read about him until I was well into grad school. And what was remarkable to me about the fact that that tradition is so far gone from any kind of mainstream education, which is such an integral part of like the specificity of American culture. And the whole idea that you're educating for the long haul, that things like teaching folks how to engage in strike action, how to organize, how to talk to people about organizing, that was productive work. But you didn't expect to see the results of it, maybe even in your lifetime.
No, that's true. And the civil rights are good. The civil rights movement took off in the 30s. And it, Martin Luther King, great figure, but it was...
Now we have part three, the final part of the interview with Noam Chomsky from November 22nd, 2011. And this last segment is a little bit shorter than the previous two, runs about a little over nine minutes. And it focuses in part about the, you know, Occupy colleges. There were some movements at the time of Occupy in 2011, which was, you know, had these Occupy colleges, and there was an Occupy Kutztown chapter, for example, at my university. And so the question for this final segment was, you know, is there a role for universities in political struggle? And you'll hear a lot of our discussion revolved around Chris Hedges' book, at least initially. Chris Hedges' book, The Death of the Liberal Class, and he is very down about colleges and universities. And I knew that Chomsky had a different take on this, so I was really curious to see what he had to say about it. Let me give you just a heads up to try, if you made it this far, listen to the end of this segment. And if you don't, you run out of time, skip to the end and you hear what he's talking about. The importance of winning small victories in building social movements. He says it towards the end of the segment. Not sure exactly the timestamp on it, but do check it out. It's worth hearing and kind of remembering. So here it is, part three, the final part of my interview with Noam Chomsky from November 22nd, 2011. Occupy colleges, is there a role for universities in political struggle?
This kind of goes specifically to the kind of the place of the university in all of this. I've recently been rereading Chris Hedges' book, The Death of the Liberal Class. And you know, he is, I'm sure you know this, he's a really scathing critique of kind of liberal institutions and talking about the kind of complete sell out to kind of corporate interest and the hollowing out of any possibility of this dedication to the teaching of critical thinking, critical analysis that might serve the kind of long-term movements. Then he also talks about how, you know, they stood by and actually helped silence some of the more kind of radical critics within this. Given that, you see students that are now fairly active in this Occupy movement, You see attempts to kind of move back into kind of the university. How do you see the university in all of this? Is there even the possibility that this institution can still contribute in the ways that kind of Chris Hedges is critiquing, contribute to actually building the kind of critical analysis and long-term sense of struggle? Or are we too far gone at this point?
I mean, this is a real creed de coeur, you know, this part. And, well, I think it's a great book. He's a terrific guy. I like him very much. But I think this is overstated. In fact, you know, there's kind of a sense of a past golden age that we're there. And there never was a past golden age. In fact, if you go back 50 years, I think the universities are a lot worse than they are now. The effect of the 1960s on the university was significant. People came out of that atmosphere who were committed to critical analysis, activism, and change. And the country's changed enormously, and the universities did. So it just take my own university as an illustration, but it's across the country. So I'm at MIT, so premier of science, engineering, at the University of the World. But when I got there in the 1950s, it was white, male, conservative, well-dressed. You wore a jacket and a tie all the time, even if you visited your friends on Sunday. That meant deferential. You do your work, you don't ask any questions. But that was the atmosphere. Nothing going on. Take a look. Walk down the halls today. It's half women, third minorities, casual dress, kind of like rude dress, which means informal relations. That means questioning issues such as central issues at a place like MIT, like what's the role of technology in society. Nobody asked those questions in the 50s and 60s. Your job is to do your work. Tumblr or song about Werner von Braun. Mm-hmm. I don't care where the missiles come down. That was essentially the attitude. He was satirizing. He was there, and he was satirizing something that was quite real. By around 1970, that was changing. In fact, it was even under student pressure. The institute actually got to the point of calling off a whole day just to deal with questions of science, technology, what are they for, what should we try to do, what kind of society we want. That would have been unheard of, inconceivable 5 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And it left a permanent stamp. And now issues like that are alive. There's a lot of activism, the Occupy movement, things going on all the time. You walk down the halls with souls, you know, for every imaginable purpose. People are interested in things. It's just changed enormously. Mm-hmm. And I think you don't expect the universities to be radical institutions. Sure. They're conservative institutions, and they're going to stay like that. But they do have openings, and I think the openings are a lot wider than they were. Actually, my experience is kind of a little unusual, but it's not untypical. In the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, at the early stages, there was protest was just crushed. I mean, we couldn't even have public demonstrations in Boston until 67, because it broke out violently by students.
By students.
Yeah, and then it changed. But there was also the beginnings of the resistance movement, not just protest, but draft resistance, deserters, tax resistance, a whole set of what are called illegal activities. The center, the academic center of that, was actually a lab where I was working at MIT, which was 100% funded by the Three Armed Services. That's the kind of an indication of the kind of opportunity that is available in universities, which have, you know, there is a tradition of free inquiry. It's not observed, you know, plenty of deficiencies, but it's there. You know, can't deny that it's there. And it can come out and flourish if people have the will and dedication. And I think that's true all over. I'm sure it's true here.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's So, Chris is correct. They are conservative institutions of a support power overwhelmingly that aren't asked questions. But within them, there are opportunities to do things. In fact, they're the freest institutions in the country. So I think they have a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And it's really good to see this kind of, take hold. And there's several different initiatives right now that are taking hold on college's campus to kind of really build some of the things that we're planning on here. We just launched our own little Occupy Kutztown, and we're talking about little things like, okay, starting with the concrete developments, like let's look at banks. Where is the bank? University banks at Wells Fargo. Let's get that money out of Wells Fargo. Let's get in community-based banks. Let's get in credit unions and move on. Under the whole idea that the government's not going to help us, state's not going to help us, we have to do it for ourselves. So use the university as an institution.
Even get down to more concrete things than that. Like a lot of the really effective organizing in the country has begun with things like getting a traffic light on a street where kids have to cross the street. It doesn't sound like much, but if the community can get together to get that, they get the sense that we can do something. If we work together, we can achieve something. Okay, let's go on to the next thing. But these are not trivial things. And that's the way organizing has to take place wherever it is. And that's what the Occupy movement ought to be doing at this point, I think. One of the interesting developments, I don't know where it'll go, was the Occupy the Hood movement.
Mm-hmm.
If they could, we're like in Boston, happy to be downtown Boston, who are mostly black community in Roxbury. Well, if it could have linked up, maybe it still can, to the main Occupy movement off the financial center, that would be a step forward. Now, they have different concerns and interests. They have local, very real local concerns and interests, which are significant. But the people who were talking about, getting rid of too big to fail banks and getting money out of politics and other big things, if they can also get involved in the actual day-to-day problems of people who are facing hard lives, it's mutual and interactive, and they can learn a lot from it, and they can bring other people along. I think that's the kind of thing that has to be.
Well, I don't want to hold you up too much longer. I appreciate so much you taking the time out. I know you've got an incredibly busy schedule, so I just wish you a happy Thanksgiving and with the family and everything else. So take care, and I hope you enjoyed your stay here at Kutztown.